You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on news that made headlines this week, and there's a lot to get to today. Our panel today, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Rachel Spacek, who covers agriculture, Latinos, and Kenyon County for the Idaho Press. Hey, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Gemma.
So
Happy Friday.
Hey, we need to start with some news that's came out this morning. Central District Health held a board meeting this morning and lifted the mask mandate in Ada and Valley counties. However, it's now a strong recommendation that that people still continue to mask. And we should note that at the same time, Idaho Health and Welfare confirmed that the South African variant is now in Idaho. Apparently, a man living in Southwest Idaho who recently traveled abroad. So, you know, Melissa, this is, you know, this all happens, and we should note too that Dr. Epperle, who is on the board of Central District Health, said that the UK variant of coronavirus has a much larger impact on children, ages 6 to 12. And it spreads faster. The lethality rate is 20% higher. So, right as all of this is going on, we then take the mask mandate away.
Right, and it's also important to note that that vote on the mask mandate removal, switching that to an advisory, was unanimous. So everybody, including those on the board who were concerned about that UK variant, did look at the dropping case rates and did decide that removing that mandate was the right move and switching that to a strong advisory. It's also very important to note that individual cities may still have their own restrictions. Boise, of course, is the big example here. So
McCall as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just because you live in Valley County, just because you live in Ada County, doesn't mean that you might not still be under a public health order. It just might be citywide instead of countywide. So it's a complex discussion, just like everything in this pandemic. It's an ongoing conversation. And as we have these new variants that we know now are in the state, Dr. Epperle said, just because the public health order changes, it doesn't mean that the pandemic is over.
Oh, right. And Rachel, I want to bring you into the conversation as well, because, you know, a lot of this, too, is there's so much discussion around should schools reopen, should they not reopen. The Boise School District just yesterday voted to start bringing children back, I believe at least elementary school children, back fully in person. But Rachel, this has been going on in Nampa, at least at the elementary school level, for a while, correct?
Yeah. And I did think that was, I don't know, it was kind of a crazy thing going on in my head, because I briefed that new variant found in the Southwest Idaho man, while at the same time, you know, listening to now the Valley View School District open for secondary students. So it was just an odd thing watching these school districts start conversations about reopening, whether that be for secondary or elementary school students, while, you know, these new variants are being found. But yeah, so basically Nampa has had elementary school students back for a while, and they just voted to have secondary students return 4 days a week, March 29th. So that's after spring break. Valley View just voted to have secondary students return back the week before spring break. And then Caldwell still has secondary students not returning yet, but has elementary returning that March 29th date. And then Boise, I believe, is March 11th or March 9th for elementary, and then that March 29th after spring break for secondary. So lots of stuff happening at the school district level. And I think this is kind of just following national trends with school districts starting to have conversations about what reopening looks like.
Right. And I mean, I don't think there's any easy answers with this at all, right? I mean, I think every parent wants their child back in school in some capacity. But you know, there's so many factors in that. And speaking of factors and what's going on, I mean, Melissa, you cover the State House and there is a lot going on there. And I want to start with really how contentious things got in the last couple of days in regards to what, to a bipartisan bill, we should note, that was brought in regards to picketing outside of people's homes.
Right. This was legislation that was brought from Republican Representative Greg Cheney, who is the chairman of the House Judiciary and Rules Committee, and Boise Democratic Representative Brooke Green. And it said that targeted protests at an individual's home that were meant to annoy or harass would be criminalized at this point. There was a hearing on Wednesday that was very contentious. As you said, it resulted in one arrest. And that hearing will continue this afternoon. There are still more people who have signed up to testify on that. And that evening, some of the people who were upset about the bill ended up showing up at Representative Cheney's home in Caldwell to do the very thing that he said he wanted to prevent in the future. I want to note that as contentious as this hearing was and how and that contention dominated the conversation, there are actually some really interesting First Amendment questions here. If a protester stays on a public right-of-way like a sidewalk or the street, should that be covered under the First Amendment? Is it a reasonable restriction from the government to say, no, you cannot protest in a residential area? I'm actually really looking forward to the committee discussion on this. Presumably that's going to be this afternoon unless it gets put off again. And this has been, this type of law has been passed in other states before. It has been challenged in other states before and made it to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1988. So this idea isn't new. And as far as whether or not it's constitutional, the Supreme Court has said it depends on how it's worded, but a 1988 challenge to this type of law in Wisconsin was upheld, or the law was deemed constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. That said, it was written in a slightly different way.
What's interesting too, Melissa, is, I mean, it takes me back to being in college and having to take a media law class. And one of the things you learn about is that, you know, can you be off of someone's property as a journalist and still, you know, maybe get video, right? And what we were taught was if you are not on their property, you can. Now with that said, you know, it is going to be interesting to hear that conversation. Is that different than if you were going and you are, I mean, burning an effigy, you know, which is what happened outside of Representative Cheney's house the other night.
Right. There was a stuffed animal that was hung in effigy. And so at what point does that cross the line from a freedom of expression, a protest, to an actual action of harassment or intimidation or a threat?
And when there are young children living in the home, right? So there's so many, but frankly, that also goes back to what are your morals and your ethics, right? I also want to talk, Dawn, about this land swap, this proposed land swap in McCall. This has been going on for a while. So kind of update us on how this happened and then where we are now with it.
Yeah, so Trident Holdings, which is fronted by a gentleman by the name of Alec Williams, hopes to convince the state of Idaho to swap an area of 26 square miles that surrounds McCall for some timberland in North Idaho. And you might hear that and go, how is that even possible? And what do you mean a swap? Well, the vast majority of the most high-profile land around McCall, you know, if you stand in McCall and look out over the lake and you see all those tree-covered hills, that's held in the Idaho Land Endowment. which is controlled by the Idaho Land Board. This traces back to Idaho's founding as a state. It is written into Idaho's constitution that these lands be managed for the highest possible return, primarily for Idaho's school children. And Mr. Williams and Trident have essentially come up with an idea that would have them buy some timberland up in North Idaho from private sources, and then swap that to the state of Idaho for the land around McCall. Trident says what they want to do is they want to take large swaths of this land and expand Ponderosa State Park. Of course, they have to pay for it somehow, and they would do that by what they call targeted clusters of development. And they've identified some general ideas for this, but it would include potentially homes in the hills around Payette Lake, where as presently there are none. It would include some development in town. As you can imagine, a lot of people are not real pleased about this. A broad array of conservation and outdoor groups have come out in opposition to this. And anybody who's been in McCall lately probably has seen the red and white signs that say oppose the land swap. There was a hearing on this in front of the land board in December before a formal proposal was made. And every single person who testified against it. There was nobody testifying in support. The thing that happened this week that is new is Trident made a formal proposal to the Idaho Department of Lands to set this in motion. Currently, there's a moratorium on any swaps in the area that was put in place this summer, really in response to the initial discussions to this. And it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. Trident provided me with a copy of their application. It's about 73 pages long. Trident chose to redact 64% of that.
Wow.
And so it was very hard as a reporter to gauge just what's in it, what the value of the lands are, and a whole bunch of other factors. I'm continuing to work on this. We've written 4 or 5 stories and I've really been following this closely because I think people across Idaho really care about this. And it's tricky because you can say, okay, the assertion that Alec Williams makes is these things are going to develop anyway. The land board has been doing these kind of piecemeal sales of lots and other pieces of land around there. So this could happen anyway. His thesis is, why don't we do this all at once? Use what he says is the power of private enterprise to find a way to put big pieces of this land into permanent conservation easements. Of course, a lot of people are very fearful of that. And, you know, McCall is I think, special to Idahoans. I'll disclose, I got married there. And at the first hearing on this, Governor Little said, I think he believed he proposed to his wife in McCall. And, you know, I think everybody really holds McCall very close to their heart. And so anything that talks about a big change there is going to generate a lot of interest.
Right. Absolutely. Let's take a quick break and we'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable, our panel today, Dawn Day, founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Press. Melissa, I want to head back to the State House because a lot going on there. We know that we've had some cases of COVID in the State House, and what, just this week, 2 senators were diagnosed?
Right. We found out this week that 2 senators have tested positive for COVID-19. Senator Steve Baer and Senator Van Burtenshaw, both from Eastern Idaho. So Senator Burtenshaw, according to Betsy Russell of the Idaho Press, was actually admitted to the hospital. He has since been released, thank goodness. We also know that so far this session, other staffers have tested positive. So I have spoken to a few lawmakers and other employees, and obviously everyone is concerned. There's also, I think, a sense of relief that it hasn't been worse. As you've talked about on this program, as we've talked about on Idaho Reports, there just aren't there are mitigation efforts at the legislature, but masks aren't required. Social distancing isn't required. Committees have varying practices on how well that social distancing is enforced. And so I think that, frankly, the legislature has been very lucky that the beginning of their session coincided with the gradual decline of cases statewide.
Mm-hmm. And also, Melissa, talk to us about some conservative lawmakers. What they're upset, saying that their legislation is not being heard.
Absolutely. There are a number of conservative lawmakers who are upset that bills that they have written and introduced have not had hearings. So in the Idaho legislature, just because you have a piece of legislation doesn't mean it's guaranteed a hearing. A lot of times that's up to either leadership or the chairman of any given committee, the committee to which that legislation is assigned. So we're talking a number of bills. One would repeal the grocery tax. One would immediately end the state of emergency. Bills like that have not gotten hearings. Again, that's the discretion of the chair. So to protest that, a number of lawmakers have pulled parliamentary moves, and this is where it gets a little bit wonky. Usually the legislature doesn't read the full text of any given bill during their floor sessions. If they did, this would be a full-time legislature. They would be there all day, every day, just listening to the House clerk read bills. So what normally happens at the beginning of the debate for every bill, they decide as a group to skip the reading of that legislation and just move straight to the introduction and debate. But anyone can object to that suspension of the rule. And that's what we saw this week. So basically, it's a parliamentary move to slow down the House proceedings. And it's a pretty good way to let people know that you're annoyed. It's a tactic that we see usually at least once a year. This isn't anything new. Mm. I've seen both conservative Republicans and Democrats use this move over my time covering the legislature. Most of the time it is, the more conservative lawmakers who do this. And so that lasted for about 2 days, I think it was. I think much to everyone's relief, they stopped that right as the House was about to consider a 50-page bill that dealt with insurance that would have taken hours to read. These conservative lawmakers continue to let people know that they're upset. They've taken turns making speeches on the House floor, letting people know that their constituents have told them that they want the emergency order ended, regardless of how it affects federal funds that come into the state.
Mm. We'll get to that emergency fund in just a moment, Melissa. But Don, this is not a surprise here, but housing prices, they are still out of control.
Yeah, you know, Gemma, when your producer asked for our story pitches, I was like, well, I guess I need to pitch this because we've talked about it on this program a lot. The median price of a home in Ada County for January stood at $454,000. Wow. In January 2020, a year ago, pre-pandemic, mind you, the median price stood at $363,000. That's a jump of 25% in just a single year. And how I was like to like look at numbers in different ways and break them down. And if you do that and you look at that, it shows that the median price of a home rose at a clip of $7,500 a month, every single month over the last year. And I know a lot of people who don't take home paychecks that are $7,500 a year, even with a two income house. And Canyon County not faring much better. The median there is at $338,000. I will note it was actually down very slightly from December, but from a year ago, it was up from $256,000. So the numbers are a little lower in Canyon County, but the year-over-year change is actually almost 33%, up a third. So home prices are actually growing more quickly in Canyon County right now than in Ada County. And the other part about it is these homes aren't staying on the market long. So if you want a home here in Ada County or Canyon County, and you say, you know what, I'm going to list it. Data shows that in January, the average home sold or at least went pending in 15 days.
Really?
Which is insane. I've owned a couple homes and sold a couple homes, and I.
Oh, it took me longer than 15 days.
Yeah,
I'll tell you that.
I had one that drug on all summer. I had to take it off the market, relist it next year. I mean, you know, real estate's usually not a quick wham bam process. And you know, we're hearing a lot of sort of anecdotal stories about people listing their homes and seeing offers way over ask. There's a home, you know, my wife and I are Zillow fans, and there's a home here in Boise that we spotted that is assessed at $650,000, Zillow valued at $850,000, and the owner's listed it at a cool million.
Whoa.
And we watched it, and it went pending in like 4 days. And the challenge is, that helps yank up the price of all the other real estate in the area. And so this is a multi-layered long thing. I've had people say, well, this is a bubble. And I just go, I
don't know if it is, Don.
I don't know that it is. The New York Times ran a wonderful piece, about a week ago. And the thesis essentially was California's housing crisis is coming everywhere. And that's what's driving this. People are moving not just from California, it's important to say, but from Washington and other states where home values have done this over the last few years. They come in with a lot of equity. Maybe they bought a house at $500,000 7 or 8 years ago. It's now worth $1 million. That means they walk with a lot of equity. If they choose to move and they move somewhere smaller like Boise, their buying power is a lot higher. Combine that with low interest rates, and this isn't going to just stop anytime soon. And I think leaders are really struggling with how to get their hands around this. And frankly, I and Melissa can talk about this better than I can. I haven't seen a lot of action at the legislature really that touches on this topic, which is defining, frankly.
Well, but also, I mean, Don, you know, we look at how the pandemic has shown us how so many people can work remotely, right? Which then makes it even more attractive to maybe move to an area like the Treasure Valley. You can keep your higher income. You can work from home. You can buy the nicer home. We know that the problem, though, for local people is that salaries have not kept up with that. So if you're not moving from here, that's a real problem.
They haven't, and you know, I own a home, and it's appreciated in value a lot. And my wife and I were just talking the other day, like, well, you know, what if family situations change and we need to make adjustments in our house. And it's like, well, how? Like, even though we have a lot of equity in our home, we're very fortunate in that. We can't afford a larger home.
because the
values are crazy. And I think everybody feels this. In fact, Boise State did their public policy survey. They asked a question of Treasure Valley residents. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it was like, could you afford, if you needed to, could you afford to sell your home and buy another similarly styled home? And 83% of people in the Treasure Valley said no. And so I think we're all feeling this.
It almost doesn't matter how much your home is valued for because you can't move.
And it's leading to it's actually helping fuel this problem because the inventory is really low. There's not a lot of homes for sale on the market. It's because why would you sell your house right now? You can't, because unless you are in a phase of life where maybe you're downsizing, maybe you're older and you had kids and you're downsizing to a smaller place, or you're moving out of the market. And I think we're going to start to maybe see some of that. People who just want a like for like home, maybe in a different neighborhood, maybe they want to trade up a little bit. Maybe they just want to, you know, another 200, 300 square feet. Good luck. So that, and then that's feeding into the problem because there's no homes to buy. And so, you know, we're seeing lots of different reactions. This, Margaret Carmella reported a story this week on the Boise Land Bank. I did a story yesterday on the LA Community Action Partnership, which hopes to build 40 rent-controlled apartment units. There's some rent-controlled apartment units going in downtown Boise. The Capital City Development Corporation is working on things. I know the City of Meridian's eyeing it. So a lot of these municipal and local agencies and nonprofits are trying to figure this out, but I don't know how anybody could ever build enough units to satisfy demand and help these prices go down. And we could do a whole Idaho Matters on this, frankly. It's honestly a big, big, complicated topic.
Yeah, it is. Hey, Rachel, talk to us about the mayor of Wilder, speaking of housing, taking over control of the housing authority there.
Yeah, definitely.
As and Dawn laughs in the background.
Great segue. I love it.
I was also going to jump in on the last conversation. I'm glad, Dawn, you mentioned Canyon County, because I feel like sometimes, you know, people think of lack of affordable housing and housing crisis in Ada and Boise, but Canyon County is also not doing well on the affordable housing front. but back to Wilder. So I'm not sure if a lot of your listeners know a lot about Wilder, but it is a farming dominated community, lots of farm workers, farmers, and the housing authority, it owns a location, Chula Vista, with a number of housing units for people in need of affordable rents and also farm workers. And it was run by a separate entity from the city. It was created by the city, but run separately. And just recently, the mayor of Wilder removed the entire housing authority board, put in a new board, and then in the same meeting that he installed the new board, asked them to approve this interagency agreement that kind of allows the city to take over the housing authority. And so obviously the old executive director of the housing authority was surprised. None of the old board members were informed that they were being removed. So kind of blindsided there. And then the city told me that their goal was to kind of clean up the housing authority area called Chula Vista. And some sources were skeptical to me, saying, you know, maybe the city has plans to sell that property to a farmer. The city told me that's not in the plans, but you know, just an interesting thing, all legal, but just weird kind of unheard of situation. I talked to a number of other housing authority directors who said that type of interagency agreement between a housing authority and the city is unheard of in the state.
All right, well, keep us updated on that. Let's take a quick break. More with our reporter roundtable next. And continuing our reporter roundtable with Dawn Day, founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Press. Melissa, you had mentioned emergency powers being a bone of contention in the State House. Can you get us up to date what happened earlier this week with the House passing a bill on this?
Absolutely. After multiple attempts at writing legislation that House Majority Leadership said was trying to strike the right balance between allowing the governor to be able to quickly respond to an emergency, as well as putting some limits on those powers. House Assistant Majority Leader Jason Monks sponsored legislation that says a governor cannot change laws during an emergency declaration, that any rule changes restrictions that are associated with an emergency declaration, you know, like a person can't go into a specific area during a fire or a flood, that sort of thing, has a 60-day limit. That limit doesn't apply to the emergency declaration as far as federal funds go. So it wouldn't be like previous proposals that would affect FEMA funding, for example.
Okay.
It also says that an emergency declaration cannot affect the ability of people to work. There's no, you know, moving forward, there would be no essential versus non-essential workers. And it wouldn't allow the governor to limit things like religious worship and group gatherings that would be otherwise protected under the First Amendment. It passed after a fairly lengthy debate with concern from Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers that this was trimming the governor's ability to respond to an emergency a little bit too much. But it did pass with the overwhelming majority of the Republican caucus in support of it. It now heads to the Senate.
Okay, so we have to wait for what the Senate does. And then with that being said, there is a bill right now that would make it harder to get voter initiatives on the ballot. Melissa, we've seen this before, and this seems to be something that comes up, feels like fairly often at the legislature.
Now, we saw this in, and I'm sorry, my kid was on my lap and he just woke up. So you might hear.
Don't you? Uh-oh. Oh, don't you worry about it at all.
I'm so sorry. Well, he has thoughts about talking about legislation, apparently.
Don't we all?
I might go on mute for a second.
Okay, go on mute and we'll come back to you, Melissa. Dawn, I was a bit surprised by this about Boise getting another nonstop flight back east, but with it, a new airline.
You and me both, sister.
Yeah.
I saw it and my eyes popped out of my head.
Right.
So let's go back just a little bit. So the Boise Airport, I'm going to bury the lead here, but I'm doing it on purpose. The Boise Airport has been working on a East Coast destination for a long time.
Right.
They had finally landed, pun entirely intended, a new destination to Atlanta. And then the coronavirus pandemic broke out. You might have heard of it. And then the flight was called off. And I was like, well, there goes the East Coast destination. And then late in the year, they said, you know what? Hey, we're going to do it. We're going to fly to Atlanta. And everybody's like, yay. Last week, the airport said, oh, P.S.
Yeah, by the way,
we're going to fly direct to Nashville. And everybody's like, what is going on? And then earlier this week, much to my surprise, the Boise Airport announced not only are they going to get a new flight to a big destination, it's a new airline. And so here's that buried lead. JetBlue will start flying direct nonstop from Boise to New York City to JFK International Airport starting in July. The service is currently being called seasonal, meaning it would then stop in September, just a couple months later. And there's one more caveat. This is going to be a red eye. So if you're wanting to fly from Boise to New York, you're going to fly overnight. You can also then fly back. So they're going to kind of, you know, do their usual circuit type of thing. It'll be 4 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. So, you know, if the pandemic has improved or if you're willing and comfortable with traveling, you could hop a flight just before midnight at the Boise Airport, wake up the next morning in the Big Apple, spend a few days there all on a direct flight on JetBlue. It also is interesting, and I didn't put this in the story, but it is interesting because JetBlue just announced a code share with American Airlines, and this actually opens up a lot of connecting options. So you could fly on one ticket, go from Boise to New York, and then New York to any of the American Airlines destinations across the Eastern Seaboard. Pricing for the tickets, we don't know that yet. They haven't actually released the flights. I imagine that'll come in the next month, but pretty interesting. All of a sudden, we're getting more options out of Boise. The airport now has 23 direct nonstop destinations, and they've added a bunch. The three I mentioned, they added Palm Springs recently and a few others. So we're moving on up in the world, at least as far as flights.
So, Dawn, what do you think this means? I mean, especially with JetBlue coming into the market, I mean, it kind of sounds like it's almost exploratory, right? Like, let's see how this goes. And if it goes,
looks
well,
like a test, sounds like a test, right?
Yeah.
They announce it.
Right.
And I think it starts July 2nd, if I remember correctly, and goes through September. So you're looking at like 3 months, which it's not a very long time. But they say in the news release, if it's successful, that they'll continue it. I imagine it'll have some takers. You know, I would think so. It has some attraction. I would guess to business people. You know, certainly for leisure travel, New York City is a great destination. And getting there previously, I went several years ago when I worked at Channel 7 for an awards dinner, frankly. And I think I had to stop twice.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember, but I had to fly to Newark. I had to like connect and fly to Newark and take a train. Oh.
Now you're closer to the city in JFK. JFK. Yeah, but you're closer to the city coming into Newark than you are to JFK. Melissa,
there's that.
Melissa, before we let all of you go, I do want to get back to the voter initiative and where and what's going on with that. And I hope the babe's doing all right. I know this is rough.
You know, it's hard to be a baby.
It's hard to be
I'm so sorry about that.
It's hard
friend.
To be a mom every day, but right now it's even harder.
Yes, voter initiatives. What would you like to know? There is a new proposal in front of the Senate. What do you want to know?
I want to know the update. So this is, I mean, as we know, this has happened before. We've seen it before. It's a push basically to make it even more difficult to get an initiative on the ballot. And we should note, this is how Medicaid funding finally happened in Idaho, was a voter initiative.
Well, there are a number of laws that have been overturned, frankly, that were the result of voter initiatives. And often the legislature responds by making it harder to get initiatives on the ballot. We saw this in 2011 and 2012 after Students Come First passed with support from all over the state in Idaho, both rural and urban. We saw this post-Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. So what this proposal would do would force ballot gatherers, or sorry, signature gatherers, to get 6% of registered voters to sign on and verify those signatures. Because as you know, in a lot of signature collecting drives, a lot of those signatures end up getting thrown out. So 6% in all 35 of Idaho's legislative districts. Right now, it's 18 of Idaho's legislative districts. This is similar to a proposal that we saw in 2019 post-Medicaid expansion. But that one was different in that it would have raised it to 10% of qualified electors in most of Idaho's districts, and it would have shortened the signature gathering period to 6 months instead of 18 months. This current proposal would leave that at 18 months, but it would up the number of legislative districts where that's required to all 35 of Idaho's. James Dawson of Boise State Public Radio, your coworker, is actually gonna be on Idaho Reports today to talk about that initiative. But after lengthy testimony in Senate State Affairs this week, in which most people who showed up to testify either in person or remotely were against the bill, that ended up passing out of State Affairs with 6 people voting yes, 3 voting no. That is on to the full Senate. And then if it passes the Senate, we'll head on to the House. Remember this, the 2019
and I've got to wrap you, Melissa.
Vetoed.
Okay, and I have to wrap you guys up.
So we'll keep following it.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you all so much. Appreciate your time. More Idaho Matters next.